Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borakthong, Earthlets, and welcome to the latest episode of the 2008 Thrillcast Lockdown Tapes. I am your host, as always, Molchar. And on this episode, we have writer Alec Worley and artist Danny, who are on to talk about the Blackbeth and the Devils of Al-Qadesh one-shot special, which is out now from all good comic book stores and newsagents, and is out in the States in a month's time. This is an expanded special based on the 1970s/1980s character, a bit of mystery involved in how she came to be. High fantasy, Slayer-style character, really great action. What really stands out with this special, not just Alec Worley's great story, but Danny's artwork. I mean, Sergio Toppi, eat your heart out. It's absolutely stunning stuff. So make sure you grab a copy of that. It's available, as I said, from newsagents and comic book stores, as well as from our web shop and app. So we got them to talk about that because it seemed rather special, and it's nice to see, you know, other characters getting particular themed specials. Hope you enjoyed the Henry Flint revisited interview last week. Next week, we're going to be hearing one of my all-time favorite interviews, which is with one of my all-time favorite artists, which is Arthur Ranson. You might be able to just be able to see a couple of his pages in the background there. Artist on, well, Judge Anderson, Judge Dredd, Maze World. I'm not going to wax lyrical. I'll just let you hear the interview for yourself from a few years ago. So that'll be next week. But in the meantime, we're going to crack on, as always, with the interview with Alec and Danny to talk about Blackbeth and the Devils of Al-Qadesh. But I wanted to talk about Blackbeth because I think we've had you both on to talk about Blackbeth before, haven't we?
I think so.
I remember talking about Blackbeth on the Scream Misty one once.
Yeah. I think that's what it was. So things have moved on a little bit since then. Alec, do you want to tell us a little bit about how Beth has gone from being one of the stories in the Screaming Misty special to having her own standalone one-shot special?
Well, I picked up the holiday special back in 88, was it? I think the original one, when I was on holiday, I think in Norfolk or something. And it was just this weird fantasy strip that just appeared in the middle of what I thought was going to be a horror magazine. But I was bang into fighting fantasy, Citadel miniatures, Tolkien, Hulk the Slayer, everything at the time when I was a kid, and was just blown away by the strip. And I kind of became a little bit obsessed with it over the years. And then there was never any other episode of it. Despite me searching the shelves for one, I didn't really know what happened to it or what the origin of the strip was. And then Keith was doing the Scream Misty special, and I emailed him at one point saying, "You guys have got the rights for Scream, right? So do you have the rights to Blackbeth? What the heck's Blackbeth?" Well, it was this strip that appeared in the holiday special back in 1988, and no one's ever heard of, I think, except me. And you checked out and you did have it. So I was like, I just straight away said, "Please, can I pitch you something? And please, can you get Danny on board?" Because we worked on Fate of the Fairy Hunter for the Scream Misty special. Yes. And I just thought, perfect. She'd be absolutely perfect. So that was pretty much it. And then it just kind of went from there, really.
Because those watching on YouTube will be able to see, technically behind you, some of the original artwork from back in the 1980s. But for those who don't know anything about the character, there's a bit of a mystery as to her origin, isn't there?
Yeah, I did a fair bit of detective work because I didn't expect Keith to say yes, but when he did, I was just like, oh my God. And I ran around. First thing, I had to turn the place upside down looking for my copy of the Solidy special. Couldn't find it, still can't find it. But yeah, I did a bit of detective work, and it turned out that it was commissioned in 1976 for a IPC comic that was going to be called Scream. Nothing to do with the Scream that came out in the mid-80s. And it was commissioned by, because I got in touch with Blas Glago, and he told me that he specifically remembered it was commissioned by a guy called Jack LeGrand at IPC, though he couldn't remember who the writer was. So I then started chasing up some of the other editors, because I noticed that Glago was working on Hammer House of Horror at the time. He did a couple of Hammer adaptations. And Des Skin said, no, it wasn't Des Skin, it was Barry Tomlinson. He said that they used to have these massive big ledgers of books that would explain who wrote what strip at what year and everything. And someone chucked them out. And so we'll never find out, it seems, who the writer was. Although Des Skin seemed to think that Ian Gibson had a hand in it somewhere down the line. I don't know how he fitted in or how accurate Des's memory there was. I tried to check it. The only way I could get onto him was via Facebook, and I couldn't activate my account again to double check that. But yeah, I'm pretty sure he said Ian Gibson was involved in it somewhere. But that was it. It remained, the writer's identity remains a mystery. And then the original Scream got cancelled, and then the artwork just lay in a drawer for like over 10 years. And then in 1988, they dug it out because they didn't have to pay for it now. There it is. And it went to the special. And then it just kind of disappeared again until me and Danny and Keith brought her back, I guess.
Because it's definitely a character of her time, isn't it? That you know, you had that huge 1970s boom in fantasy. You know, you obviously got the adaptations of Conan and Red Sonja. So she fits into that milieu. But tell me a little bit about how and if you tried to update her as a character.
Really, it was just, again, it was just kind of doing the way you would with it, what I would with any kind of character, is just kind of zeroing in on rereading the old strip a few times and just trying to dig out who she is as a character, and then refit that along. Well, who are we writing this for? We're not really writing this for guys who would have read the original. We're kind of reading this for a new younger audience, a kind of a YA audience. So then you just kind of adapt certain things of it. Like, I made Beth a little bit less of a kind of swoony damsel, and I made them both a lot younger. Like, we based her on Barbara Steele, wasn't it? A young Barbara Steele. It's weird because I kind of had an image slightly of Danny herself in my head as well as I was kind of writing it. So yeah, kind of like you and Barbara Steele. And we made Quido a lot younger as well, and made him a bit more of a kind of equal footing, because in the original strip is very much kind of, it's a bit sub-dom, to be honest. It's a bit kind of, you know, mistress and servant. And so we kind of leveled him out a little bit more. And I think I based Quido on Liam Hemsworth, I think, in the end.
Ooh.
And hot dude with like a six pack in his shirt and stuff. But I mean, but in terms of design, I kind of gave Danny free rein on that. I mean, we brought Mildred the witch as well, and I just said, right, Danny, you do what you want with this. So Danny, what did you do there?
I love Mildred. Well, you described her as just a hag. Is this a word? Like an old hag?
Yeah. Just kind of as she was in the original. But then... Sorry, go on.
No. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, you kind of did her in this, like, you had all this, like, furry texture. You just kind of made her, like, this kind of really... Because she just looked like a bog-standard... like crone in the original, and you just turned her into like this kind of crazy animal looking lady with all the fur who just looked like she stank, and yeah, it was just great.
I guess she stinks, I'm sure she does. Well, I have this ever since I had watched Blair Witch Project as a kid, I remember I think it was towards the end or one of the interviews that they were giving to each other that one person said that she had fur, like a hairy Hans, the witch.
Yeah.
And ever since, it has stuck in my mind that witches are hairy. So it's it was like a one way for me, like a one path to add hair on her hands. And I guess all the fur and I don't know how to describe it. I just wanted to make her, give her a lot of fur and make it a bit complex where the fur starts and where the skin starts. And it's just like rags, many fur rags. But what I wanted to add is that in your question, Michael, about the making Beth new, is that the stories Alec writes are new. Like what you said about the audience, that there is, it's another audience now. And I've noticed that at least the, no, all three of the stories we've done together, it's about Beth defending the different somehow. Yeah. No? Yes?
Yeah, totally.
Yes, and it's, this is so what is happening nowadays. And I don't know about the old one, if it's like that exactly, but at least the new ones are like that.
I think the old one's pretty, I mean, like, it's like Mike said, it's like it was very, it was of its time, not to knock it. But yeah, she kind of, she does, I think in the original one, she's about to get married and her village gets wiped out by raiders, as every sword and sorcery hero's family gets wiped out by raiders. And then she kind of gets plucked from the ruins by this hunchbacked blind guy, Quido, who carries her off, teaches her to sword fight, even though he's blind. And then he makes her this suit of armor, and then she kind of takes her vow against, it's that bit there. That's the scene where she, they shall know me by the name that I now adopt, by which I swear to combat evil in all its vile forms, Black Beth. And then she's just got that awesome armor and all the rest of it. And then off she goes and she beats up the dude that wiped out a village. And then it just kind of ends in that classic fashion of just them riding off into the sunset. And you know, back in the 80s, there was me going, what happened next, and never found out. So this is just like a dream come true to be able to continue that. But it's like Danny said, in terms of it, this, because the original was a lot less, I guess, what they would call low fantasy. I mean, it wasn't really even a fantasy. It was, you had black magic in it, but there weren't monsters. I think we've made it much more like a kind of Harryhausen movie, more like kind of slightly more fantasy, but the tone is a bit more controlled. But also, I mean, as a kid, I loved, still love, like Siddle miniatures, 80s fantasy movies, Conan comics, Red Sonja comics, but it's less about homaging a specific thing and more about just trying to recreate the spirit, how good you thought that stuff was. Like Spielberg, when he did Raiders of the Lost Ark, he wasn't trying to remake a specific Saturday morning serial. He was trying to recreate how he felt as a kid when he was watching that. So with these stories, I'm just trying to get across that sense of the exotic and something, and just mystery and adventure and just exhilaration and all these kind of things that are possibly going on beyond the frame of what you can't see, and plenty of monsters. And pretty much every monster in there, I just kind of said, okay, these guys need to come from out of the sea. Danny, do what you want to do with it. And then she just kind of comes back with these crazy monsters. I think like the owl and the big pterodactyl, I just kind of said, do what you want. She came back with those.
Well, let's talk about this artwork, because the previous stories have been in black and white. And when Keith sent through the artwork for this one, I was quite blown away, because this is in color, and you know, forgive me if this is an accidental homage or whether it was intentional, very much kind of channeling Sergio Toppi. And I mean, just tell us about your thought process on the style for this one.
Well, I think Sergio Toppi is channeled throughout the whole comic. I'm sure about this, even the first ones, because I really like how, I always liked how he, what's the word? Sorry, once again, every time I ask sorry about my Greek English. Thank you for being patient with me. I always liked how he managed all the details in armors or whatever. And it was I thought it was really appropriate to channel all this and try and have my version, because he's also one of the artists, and one of the first comics that I've read was a Sergio Toppi comic, which my cousin had brought me from France back when I was in high school. So I was really into it. And well, the colors, first of all, I'm not really well with colors. I'm quite new with colors, because I've always colored stuff, but not professionally. I've had some small exceptions, but I've never colored such a big comic. It was the first time. And I think I came with a more fine arts mindset. I channeled my fine arts years in college, and Toppi, of course, because I couldn't do it in a more industrial way. I just couldn't do it. I thought it wouldn't be that personal, and it came naturally that I would draw each panel differently from the other. And I hope it's not too confusing. And some good feedback. So I'm really happy Keith was positive with me doing it. And it's also symbolic, because it was like, for 2008, it was my first comic ever professionally. And again, my first colors professionally, it was for you guys, and it was great.
One of the things that really struck me, that I, you know, does evoke that kind of Toppi style, is the way that you often use color to wash out the black, the ink work that you've done. So there's that wonderful panel with, I don't want to give any spoilers for plot or anything, but you've got an image of Beth, and then next to kind of close up of a face of like a priest like figure with
a hat.
And there's like a wonderful purple that washes through the black. So it's not just creating kind of tonal depth in the face. Oh, there we go. Oh, for those not on YouTube, Alex has tried to hold it up to the screen, and Zoom went, no. That's my grand.
Well, Alex is lucky, because he has it like the post office in Greece is so slow. I still have my coffee. But yeah, I mean, I think I got carried away a bit, and I got into coloring so much that I started coloring even the inks. And at some parts, it just made my life a bit more difficult, but it's worth it. I'm happy I did it.
Well, it wouldn't be a proper artistic endeavor if you weren't actually making your life more difficult. Yeah. You know, this
no, it wouldn't.
This could be easy, but you know what? I'm going to add layers of complexity. Like that's just how artists are, surely.
Yeah, it's true, and this is how you move forward. I guess whenever you challenge yourself, if you stay in your comfort zone, and it's true for everything, not only for art, for everything. If you are comfortable, then you just stay stagnant. That's the word.
That's it.
I know English. Yes, you have to move forward and challenge yourself.
Tell us a little bit about your storytelling technique, because what really struck me was, looking at the artwork that's behind Alex from the original Black Beth, is actually how similar your storytelling is to that, where you're mixing up your panel types, getting rid of panel edges in some cases, overlaying panels, which lots of people try to do, but not many succeed. So tell us a little bit about the choices that you make in how you are putting the pages together, because I assume, Alec, you're not one of those writers who's overly didactic about how you want the page to look.
No, I've learned not to be. I remember on I did a thriller with Mike Dowling, and oh my god, I sent him thumbnails and just said, this is what I want you to draw, and it was just like, no. And I mean, bless him, he did it, but yeah, I would never ever do that to an artist ever again. That was terrible. But yeah, I'm fairly kind of vague. I mean, it's just for, not vague, but if I think I tend more to describe like expressions, just what's going through the character's head, so that the artist can then know, or I might suggest a close up or a wide shot or an establishing shot or something, just to get a vague sense. But I always say at the beginning, just if you're not feeling that vibe, then just go with how you feel it's going. But so long as we've got the emotional continuity through it. But
yeah, I guess you give a direction and then you, and the freedom to follow that direction. Yes. And it's it offers the artist the freedom and confidence to explore more things, at least for me. I'm so happy with that. And
because it's your story too, you know, so
it's our story.
Yeah, so, well, do you know what I mean? It's just kind of like you're kind of building this, you know, I'm kind of setting the stage. Mm-hmm. And then I do think that in certain media, like you'll always say that, you know, theatre is the actor's medium and film is the director and the editor's medium. I do think that comics do favour the artist, I think.
Go on.
I was going to say, I do think it's more of an artist medium, perhaps, than a writer's medium. I mean, you look at like the novel is really, that's where a writer can really show that they can write, is in the novel. But I'm just talking about preferences here, not like, you know, writers have no right writing comics, of course they do. But like, it's just, it gives the artist more space to explore out of the two. So I think you guys do the majority of the heavy lifting in comics. Sure. So it's just
thank you for recognizing us.
It's
a total combination, a collaboration.
Yeah, I guess
it wouldn't be the same with like an artist doing it on their own. It's different.
But it's still kind of just giving you the tools to do what you need to do. I mean, in the same way, like a great movie script and a great director will create something, you know, that's kind of the sum of both of them, which I guess is like the same in comics. But yeah, I'm always trying to showcase the artist, to be honest, and just kind of the writer really needs to just kind of fade into the background, because it's not about you, it's about the characters and it's about what they're feeling and thinking and blah, blah, blah. And then the artist on top of it. So yeah, I think I've always learned to kind of fade into the background a little bit on with any kind of writing, and just it's much more about the audience, it's much more about the characters, and in the case of comics it's a lot more about the artist as well, I think.
Yeah, but as an artist I have the same thing in mind, like the characters and how I complement, like, because you might have written something that a character will tell, and I want to accentuate this or give it a tone, so I have to add on this line on the script a mood that I would. Yeah. So it's a combination. We are equal.
I think there was one word that you both used there, which was confidence. And I guess from the writer's point of view, it's having the confidence in the artist, and for the artist it's knowing that you have the confidence of the writer, so no one's being, you know, no one's dictating necessarily what needs to happen. It's giving, as you say, Alec, you know, giving each other the space and
totally
the necessary information in order to make, because it's just, you know, for example, you look at pages in the Black Bear special, you know, where you've got that owl that swoops down, and I'm pretty sure Alec didn't tell you that it needed to be this beautiful turquoise blue, completely defined by the colour within its boundaries, you know. But you took that on yourself because you were able to make the call.
Yeah.
Well, he described it as a magic owl. I think you said like add anything you want, more feet, more legs, more eyes, more whatever you want, just make it So, and I would like to add that in all of this collaboration, the writer and artist collaboration, you also need, and most of the times no one says this, but you also need a good editor.
Yeah, that's true. So, yeah.
Orchestrate everything somehow. Yeah. Like it's a big part of the creative process.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I guess in the end of the day as well, like you kind of, you're saying about like giving each other space, but I mean, you also need to give the reader space to get involved, because you can't be so prescriptive with a story that you're just kind of presenting it all as a kind of give or take. You've got to leave kind of imaginative room for the reader to infer things and to kind of let their imagination fill in the gaps kind of thing. And I think especially so in fantasy, because in like if you look at what I think are like the best Harryhausen fantasy movies, which are like Jason the Argonauts, Golden Voyager, Sinbad, those have got a sense of a world that is existing outside the frame. There's always a sense that there are monsters lurking just over the next hill, and there's little lines of dialogue. I mean, even in movies, like they did it tons in Star Wars, like there was just all this dialogue that was mentioned about things that you never saw or you never found out what they were, or even in things like Hawk the Slayer, the wizards are gathering in the south. What does that mean? But there's an evocative sense to that, that you know there's something going on, and your imagination will just glom onto that, and the reader then becomes part of the story rather than you just kind of there you go, take it or leave it. It's always about leaving that space to infer. So the reader kind of becomes part of it as well. But yeah, totally. Props to the editor, Keith Richardson, just totally given us free rein on this. So couldn't be happy with that. And I've got to say as well, Andrea, who did the cover and the backup script as well. Did you know I wrote that script, 3 pages. I wrote it in Italian because he doesn't speak English.
Wow.
And I don't speak Italian.
No, Italian. Oh, how did you do that?
I did it on Google, lots of Google Translate, and using really, really simple words. So, I just kind of went back and forth on Google Translate until it kind of made sense. So it's my first script written completely in Italian. And then I had to translate his emails back to me to understand, did you mean this? Did you mean that? But yeah, so that was fun. That took about 3 times longer than a normal script. It was a 3-page script that took me about as long as a 15-page one would have.
Wow. That's a fun fact.
One of the things I was going to ask about was, what was your reaction when Keith said, well, you know, we want to do Black Beth again, but we want to do a special, so it's going to be a lot more pages. Was it a case of fantastic, I can tell a bigger story, or crumbs, you know, there's got to be more that I need to fit in?
It was just like, oh my god, like, because I think space is always such a crucial factor in comics, and it's just you've finally got when you've got that room that you can get more atmosphere in, you can get more of kind of everything in, you can just, your vocabulary expands the more pages you've got. I think that it's, for me, it's always the hallmark of a really great writer, and I will pluck one name out of the 2008 bag, Gordon Rennie, in some of the things he did in Absalom to condense time and pop back and forth between panels. So you got a sense of more happening than was actually happening on the page. That's just brilliant. That is absolutely brilliant. And I think that's what writing for 2080 teaches you. So I think when a lot of writers like Al Ewing, Rob Williams go to America and suddenly they've got 20 pages, they just go, it's just like this creative bomb going off. You then sort of see them spread their wings and you really see what they can do. But you go back to your Scott McClouds here and you look at the whole thing about aspect-to-aspect panels that you can use to build atmosphere. You haven't got time for that in 2080. You've got 5 pages, you've got to get across, and you've got, I try and average everything at 5 panels so the artist has got enough space, but ideally you want kind of 4, But then that just means scaling the story down even more. But with a bigger story like this, it was just like, oh, great. Finally, we can just and just explore her a little bit more. I'd love to bring Quido into it a bit more next time, if there is a next time. But it was just you can get more theme in, you can get more atmosphere in, you can get more in terms of the combat in. But I tended to kind of, you know, try and do the Rennie thing of just kind of condensing it down and inferring a lot more. So you're kind of packing. I really hate those comics where you can tell the art, you can tell the writers taking the mick a little bit by sort of have, I'm going to have three double page spreads of someone eating a sandwich. You're like, yeah, really, that's, you got your page rate up there, but like, really do the work, get everything down and like tell a story, get as much in there as you possibly can. So without overcrowding it. So yeah, I was overjoyed. I just thought, oh god, we can just really go to town with this. And yeah, that's how I feel. What do you think, Danny? Sorry, I've been babbling on.
No, you're saying everything so nicely. I had the same reaction. I was like, finally, she deserves a big story, and I was a bigger story, and I was really happy to explore more of her world and her character and her reactions in more pages. And yes, she deserved this. I'm happy that we did this and we had this opportunity.
Is it definitely in terms of the world? I mean, I tried to, I seem to remember trying to base it slightly on like Moorish Spain, just that very kind of arid landscape. I think in the second one we did, Witch Tree, there's a place in southern Spain, Almeria, I think, which is where they filmed all the spaghetti westerns and the original Conan the Barbarian. And the tree where Arnold is crucified on is still there. And I think I sent you, Danny, a shot of the tree, which you used as the witch tree in the second story. But yeah, just trying to get that really parched, kind of woozy, exotic, Arabic, Moorish sort of feel, lots like very Mediterranean, and I didn't know how much of that would kind of vibe with you, Danny, like living over there in the Med rather than in rainy Britain. I just have to imagine, presume you can look out of your window and see all this lovely stuff.
I watch the city outside of my window. I'm in the city center of Athens. It's not that great. Like for The Devils of Alcadesh, like the last story, I really like the scenery. And you sent me a picture of this city.
Oh, the bridge. Yeah.
That is connected with the bridge. And you said to send me this picture, and I was like, boom, okay, I can see everything. It's great when the writer just sends you or tells you one thing and you get straight into the mood of it. And for the inside of the city, I'm thankful that I visited Morocco. And because I really searched for all my photos from the trip and the whole city of Marrakesh and everything, I was really inspired of this for the city. So yes, what else about the scenery?
Yeah, just kind of dry and dusty and miles away from the Norfolk Broads in which I first.
Yeah, and this time we could, because the pages were more, we were able to change the scenery a lot. And I'm happy that I did the colors as well, because I had the chance to play with, to see how different I can, how differently we can show a transition to another, like a more wettier, for example, apartment, or more dry, and whatever. It was great.
That's one of the things about fantasy is what it's drawing on, because you look at something like Tolkien, and you know it's very obviously drawing on the kind of you know, the sagas and Anglo-Saxons and all this, that, and the other. But as the 70s progressed, there was this degree of Orientalism that came in. You know, the exoticism that you mentioned, Alec. as creators, do you kind of pay any mind to the consequences of the interplay of such elements? You know, you've got Morocco and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, do you mean in terms of in terms of what, like people's reaction to it, or like
how people who perhaps are from the cultures being referenced, are from the places being referenced, you know, because you know you're bringing in different elements from different places and putting them into a fantasy setting.
I think about that stuff to the point of utter paralysis, and I find it really unhelpful, if I'm perfectly honest. I will bunch myself into a ball in terms of, I mean, going beyond that and just looking at kind of genders within stories. I find I can make this one a woman, I can make this one this, but then what's that saying? Okay, let's roll it back, and then da 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 da, da. And that piles on the hours and piles on the, yeah, it's something you've got to get on with and do, because you do. But the thing is, I've always done that. You always have to take responsibility for what you believe the reader's response is going to be. But to kind of going back to the setting, I mean, placing these things within a fantasy setting, I think it all depends on how well you can kind of interface with a text. I mean, I see this as fantasy, and I would kind of expect the reader to believe that as well. It's not an instructional. I'm not sort of saying, I'm certainly not endorsing Beth's way of viewing the world. There's nothing in here that's too connected to actual religions or so on. It's just very much based, it's just, I guess just based on the look or the feel. Again, it's going back to sort of your, I guess, folk memory or kind of culture memory of how this stuff plays into everything. It's what Tolkien called like the cauldron of story, where just everything kind of gets thrown in and it just becomes part of the mainstream. I guess because we're not dealing with any kind of social construct in this, you don't really have to. It's just kind of free flowing. Danny, what do you think? I'm tying myself up in knots here.
I don't know what else to say on this. like for the world.
Let's say if this story was set in ancient Greece, like how would you feel about if you were sort of playing off of Greek cultures and you kind of spun it up? I guess it depends on how kind of responsible you are and how many of like old stereotypes and old biases you're bringing into it. I mean, if you were setting a story in China, let's say, and you were bringing in lots of awful stereotypes from the 20s and you don't want to go there.
You don't want to do that.
Wouldn't. I mean, I think at the end of the day, if you're a responsible, sensitive writer and you're conscious of your audience, you should be thinking of that anyway. I mean, it's something that kind of troubles me personally a bit too much. I just, okay. I will tie myself up in knots thinking about how something is going to be received, which you have to, but it's quite a weight sometimes, to be honest. And at the end of the day, you just sort of have to say, well, look, I'm sensing through what the story needs to be and what the characters need to be. I'm going to have to make a judgment call at some point and just kind of say, that's what it's got to be, and publish and be damned. Do you know what I mean? I don't know.
I guess it depends on the place you are coming from. Like if you just want to tell a story and...
Yeah.
Of course, you don't want to. You are sensitive in things you can show, or you don't want to offend anyone. You, for example, if you have cultural things that you want to show, it's because you admire these things and you want to show them. Not is it a cultural appropriation question? I don't. Something like that? No.
Yeah.
I guess it all depends in where you come from and the mindset that you come from, and you just want to tell a story, not harm anyone.
Yeah.
Hmm.
It, I mean, one of the reasons I ask is because the Black Pest special doesn't seem to succumb to what I've sort of referred to as the barbarism problem, which is that which is exotic and different is portrayed as barbarous and uncivilized, whereas, you know, the lead characters can so often be essentially the white savior, you know, coming in and setting everything out. And but, you know, that really struck me, and I'm just interested in it in terms of Beth, who is an intersection of gender and genre and all this other stuff, about whether that was a conscious choice or whether it was just something that spun out of the character and the setting.
I think just the character and the setting, and just wanting to tell a really good story. I mean, there's theme in there, but I'm not front loading it. I'm not just saying, here's a soapbox and I'm now going to yell at you for 20 pages. It's just the story is in there, and it's left for the reader to kind of infer what you will from that. But it's, I think it's going back to what her character is like, and just rereading the original story several times, and the notion of Beth being this kind of zealot. She's like the Punisher, and I'm kind of drawn to these kind of Slayer characters, I guess. Kind of, I find them quite interesting. It's just that one of my favorite comics of all time was Garth Ennis's Punisher Max series, and that is a story that takes the notion of the anti-hero, of the Slayer, of the killer anti-hero, and is completely honest about it, and is completely, on the one hand, it says, because one of the transcendent joys of storytelling is watching the bad guy or the bully get their ass handed to them. But at the same time, this is a character that is a psychopath and is completely a monster and is conscious of their own monstrousness. And it's interesting looking at characters like that. I watched Army of the Dead the other week, and it struck me again how in the Romero movies in the 70s, the notion of the toxic male redneck, whatever, who wants to go out and blow the heads off zombies, that was criticized. That was a problem back then. Now that mindset is entirely celebrated, entirely endorsed. It's part and parcel of the zombie genre now. It's great. We can now turn our guns on our neighbors and blow them away because they annoy us. And that's great fun, but also you are othering a species and making up an excuse so that you can round them up and exterminate them. That's kind of troublesome, isn't it, at least?
Yeah, specifically in the zombie genre, where zombies are kind of a metaphor already.
Yeah. But I mean, it's one of those things, and I was always struck by there was an essay that Kim Newman wrote back in the day about Buffy, and he said that the minute you can rehabilitate one vampire is the point at which the premise of the show just completely unravels, because it makes what Buffy does feel more like genocide than heroism. And it's a similar thing in Star Wars as well. Like, if you've got one stormtrooper who's sensitive and writes poetry in his spare time and then decides not to be a stormtrooper anymore, and you continue mowing them down as though they're not, well, how many other sensitive stormtroopers are you murdering now? It changes the whole moral framework of the story. Another great example is in the movie, Norwegian movie, Trollhunter. There's this guy who has to like take out trolls and clear trolls out of, he's kind of like the exterminator. And there's this one scene where I think he gets drunk or something, and he's talking about, there was one time, there was part of my job when I had to go into a cave and murder a cave full of troll babies, and that's who he is. He's a monster. As grey as it is to watch him, there is something monstrous at work in that. And bringing this back to Beth, she's kind of a monster and she's kind of a lunatic, and that's kind of why I wanted to bring Quido into it, just to kind of question that mentality slightly. Again, I'm not front loading theme here. It's just it's just something to kind of chew on as you're reading it, because it just gives it that little bit more weight and just lets it sit in your head a little bit more, and you know, makes it more memorable, I think, as well as playing off this kind of exotic adventure that you're hopefully enjoying.
Well, the fact that we are doing this conversation now, like what you said about the older films and how they treat and the same things differently now,
yeah,
it means that we are more sensitive in things, and it's great that we can have this conversation and have this way of thinking and trying to not discover, what is the word? Okay, my Greek mind is my Greek brain can't find the word, but anyway, just try and tell more like another part of the story.
I guess like you're kind of questioning what's gone before, but again, it's not. I mean, that's in there, but it's kind of it's mainly. I just wanted to do this completely non-snarky, non-homage-y, going back to how it felt watching Jason the Argonauts when I was 6 years old, you know, just that absolute sense of exhilaration and, oh my God, what's going to happen next? And kind of merging that with a modern audience who will love D&D and Critical Role and everything else. And, you know, because we're all kind of cut from the same cloth in this, and and that was really what I wanted to do with this, is really just tell like an exciting story that just had a little bit of Chewy theme in it, without going too much into stuff. But yeah, that's why. Yeah,
and sometimes this happens because you make something that you like and you tell a story that you want to read, and then people find meanings, different meanings in what you've done. And it happens all of the time.
Danny,
he's calling.
One of the things I wanted to ask about was character emotion, because as Alex said, Beth is a slayer, you know, she's fairly straightforward character. How did you approach her the kind of physicality of her character and how she expresses emotion when she's meant to be, you know, this fairly single-minded warrior?
Well, okay, I think that her expressions, if you see all the panels, she's mostly angry.
Anger's an emotion.
Yes, but she doesn't smile that much or something. She's angry all the time, and she has this expression of questioning everything, like so yeah, I guess this is the main emotion that I have in mind for Beth. I don't know if it's
that's perspective, I guess, isn't it? It's just.
But she is angry. She's a lot of anger. Like, she has a lot of anger. And she gets into situations head first. Is it this? It's like she just jumps into the situation. She doesn't think a lot. And thank God Guido is there to balance things a bit. Yeah. Yeah, he's the brains, I guess. She's smart as well.
I like Credo as a character because he brings a little balance to her, but also he's a blind man running around, so it's kind of I almost saw him in this as Beth's baby Yoda. she'd rather not have the responsibility of looking after him, but he's there and she still has to look after him, kind of thing.
He's kind of there sort of saying, look, at the end of the day we need money, so we need to do this, and maybe you shouldn't just steam in there because you're probably going to get killed. And yeah, I think he kind of helps bring a little bit of humor into it as well. I think that's the good thing about having those. I think like I was never a massive fan of the books, but the stories, but the Fafhrd and Grey Mouser stories from back in the 60s, that was about like a thief and a barbarian who ran around doing different stuff. It's always good to give, I think, if you've got a glowering loner hero, it always helps to give them someone to talk to and someone who can just counter that a little bit and just push back a little bit, because otherwise it would just be so one note. It would be completely like, intolerable. It would just be her just going the whole time. Okay.
And
yeah.
And it's a different kind of challenge for them as well, because, for example, Guido questions Beth in some things, and it's like he makes her think of a different, like have another perspective on things.
Yeah.
So cheers to these characters that make us question things.
One thing I did like about the special is in a lot of fantasy it can be very easy to be to succumb to that kind of declarative way of characters expressing themselves. You know, I did even just, you know, Beth's little speech on the original story that's behind you, Alec, you know, where makes a little speech and here I am, blah blah blah. Thinking back to I've just been listening to the audiobook of the new biography of Stan Lee that Abraham Reisman has done, and I pronounced his surname wrong there, and that talks about, you know, how a lot of the comics that came out of Marvel at the time had that very kind of in your face declarative intent, and then when they try to change that, it didn't necessarily work as well. Can it be very easy to slip into fantasy tropes in the a standard fantasy way of saying things?
I think that it's that thing, isn't it? I've heard this. I kind of feel that creeps in a bit in 2000 AD, in the notion of rationalizing, because the relationship between the story and the reader was different back in the 60s than it is in the present day. In the present day, it's a little bit more realistic. It was much more, like you say, declarative, more kind of iconic. It was more characters like, it was more Kirby-esque. Today, we're used to seeing like movies and TV, and we want everything couched a little bit more in reality. And I think this is perhaps where, going back to the setting thing, I think a lot of fantasy does tend to build upon recognizable settings, because it just helps the reader visualize it a little bit more and kind of know where they are. But in this, I mean, like I said, the first Beth was totally kind of iconic, declarative. This one had to be a little bit more drawn back and a little more subtle, because it would it's that whole thing about tone, I think, in fantasy. You've got to get that that sense of adventure, and just to plunge into it, that sense of not really holding back and being snarky about it, because that's great if you want to critique the genre, but it's if you just want to have a full-on go for it adventure that people can just enjoy, then you have to commit to it. You just have to. You can't make jokes at the expense of the genre. And so the strength, I think, specifically of heroic fantasy as opposed to like the more epic, is that the if you read like books like the Michael Moorcock books, it's just all about inventing new stuff. I want to see the same but different. I want to see cool sword fights and this fight done in different ways, different situations, but it's constantly just about invention, and just putting new stuff on it. It was like whereas I did a book years ago. Oh, I can't see it. And in that, I'm saying about the kind of scale of fantasy cinema, where you've got the realistic and the kind of surrealistic, kind of avant-garde surrealism and documentary realism and the other. So you have a kind of scale on which fantasy exists. So you have fairy tale at one end, which is this very plasticized reality. And at the other, you have epic fantasy, which is like your Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, Excalibur, that kind of thing. And then sort of just behind that, you have the heroic. And the heroic is your Conan the Barbarian. These are your, and Black Beth, which is like your frontier hero. They are Gilgamesh, they are Heracles, and they go out there and they kill all the monsters and they tame the land in preparation for civilization to come in and build all the cities that then characters like Arthur and Frodo can then strive to save in their stories. But I think in heroic, there has to be a sense of the exuberant and the declarative, and they're just the kind of like, get in there and don't hang around and overthink this too much. It's just about energy. I think. And that's something that I totally get in Danny's art as well. It's just the absolute splendor of it, if that makes sense. It just paints this total atmosphere, which is just kind of unique and lovely, and the spectacle of it as well. That's why you read and, you know, read comics like this, I think. Yeah, Danny, you nailed it, basically.
Thank you. Well, we did it together, so.
Well, Danny, I mean, that is something that has always struck me about your style, is it is very dynamic. It has an energy to it. We already discussed the influence of Toppy on that. What are some of the other things that you draw on in the way that you do comics?
I'm sorry. What in the way that I draw?
Sorry, in the way that you draw. What influences are you pulling in from outside?
Well, I get influenced by everything and everything. Like, you get inspiration, constant inspiration for every visual thing that you have. But I think that the fact that I studied fine arts really gave me a different perspective on things. My initiative when I start drawing something is to get emotionally into it first. So it's not just, I don't want to keep it just technical. And I like the atmosphere. I like drawing something, first of all, like a page that can stand as a piece of art on its own, and then every panel to be something and give everything the attention that it deserves. And so, yes, I think I approach my comics more emotionally than technically. And that's why sometimes, for example, in the background, it will be just lines, noisy lines that I'm in the zone at that time that I'm drawing them, and I don't even have in mind what I'm doing. The pencils under it, they are totally different. And it's a weird thing that's happened.
Oh, I totally get that. I totally get that. That's awesome.
Thanks. Okay, but I guess isn't it the same thing with writing? The way I imagine it is that you get so into it sometimes, like if you get into the zone, that you just flow out.
Yeah, I'll just stick a playlist on with no words in it, and you just get on with it. But you can't, I can't be doing anything else. I can't be like, you know, distracted by anything. You just got to get into it. And then it was interesting what you said about just sort of finding that emotional, falling in love with it first and getting enthusiastic. Mm. Yeah, that's it's kind of any project that you end up on, you just kind of find the thing that works for you, or how that material speaks to you, and then just find something interesting in it that you think that kind of speaks to you, and then just go, oh yeah, yeah, off we go. And then and then kind of think it through.
But yeah, and I agree with this, and I know that it might sound as a luxury to choose your project if you can, and because okay, not many people can, like, if you have to, you have to work sometimes, so you will do it. But if you just take a breath and just think, do I really like this project? Because if I like it a lot, the reader is going to like it as well, because I'll enjoy every time, like every second of making it. And you know, it's okay if you don't enjoy it that much and say no, because someone else might really enjoy doing it.
Yeah.
And it'll be a whole different thing, and it's not that it's low quality or something, it's just that we don't have the same taste. And it's really personal, this work, at least for me, I perceive it this way, that it's really personal. So it's good to choose what you are working on.
Yeah. Do you get a sense, Danny, that the work is that Michelangelo thing of like the statue's in the block, you just need to get it out. The story or the artwork knows what it needs to be. It just needs you to get it out. So you're just listening the whole time to like, what do these characters want? What do they want to do? What are they? What is this line? Where does this line want to go? And then you just follow it and you're the one doing it. Is that how it is with you?
I don't think it that much. I don't think of it that much. That's why every time I have questions, like someone has questions about the creative process and what I do and what comes first and how I think of things, I don't have a clear answer.
No, but that's, I mean, you know what? That's the best place to be, I think, is just sort of not overthinking it. That's probably why your work is so kind of, it feels so fluid and organic and just, I mean, I just speaking personally, I kind of prefer, I think this is maybe why I prefer From Hell to Watchmen, if I'm honest. I think Watchmen's wonderful. It's very cold. It's very pristine. It's as cold as a blueprint. Whereas From Hell is just totally organic and totally completely insane, and it just feels alive. Do you know what I mean? And I don't know, I kind of value things that are slightly more alive, and even if they're imperfect, just something that's just more kind of has come straight from someone rather than been thought about too much. So I kind of envy that state of mind, to be honest, because I struggle with that sometimes. I overthink ridiculously.
But it's your job to overthink things.
I guess. Yeah.
But it's also like, because you mentioned these two examples, these two books wouldn't be the same if it was the other way around. And the art is like that because it suits the story.
Yeah, exactly.
And, I've noticed, like, with me, it's the same thing that's happening. Every time I read a new script and I start working on it, I'm not thinking about it, but my style changes a bit to... And it's not deliberate to suit that story, but it happens because every script has another vibe.
Yeah. So, this is the reason why I need you to be perfect for it.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much indeed to Alec and to Danny for that fascinating chat about fantasy tropes and bringing old school characters new life. And please do support the specials when you can, as it's always nice to do something different on the newsstand. So, yeah, that's on sale now from all good stockists, as well as our web shop and app. We'll be back in a week's time with the interview with Arthur Ranson from a few years ago. As I said, one of my all-time favourite artists. And that was a great chat. It's so unusual to encounter an artist with such a not only such a long career, but also somebody who's decided to bring that to a close, but with a remarkably consistent legacy and back catalogue. So, yeah, if you didn't catch that the first time around, I'm taking the two parts of that and smushing it together into one episode. So that will be in 7 days' time. Until then, Earthlets, I hope you're all staying safe and well as the weather thinks about what it's going to do for the rest of the summer. But until then, stay safe, stay well, look after one another, and Splundig Verthrig.
Alert! 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 Fell power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.